Welcome to Newton and Co. This is another podcast for Eye for the Light. As usual, I'm here with my co-host, David Newton. David, hello.
Hi there, Chris. Good to be back. Hope you're all well. Hope everyone out there in listener land is well too. Today, we have a very interesting photographer with an incredibly interesting backstory of the sort of work that he does and also a future story too. And I'm not going to give anything else away in the introduction. I'm just going to say, please, everyone, welcome Karim Ilya.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here and to talk to you both.
We're literally going to dive straight in because I'm very excited to find out more about you. I've, you know a bit of your work and I want to know a bit more about where you've come from. So straight up, I know that you split your time between Hawaii and Iceland. Ostensibly seems very different places, but geologically, they're actually very similar, and I'm trying to work out how you ended up in these places.
That is correct. So my family is in Hawaii. My parents love to windsurf, and so that initially brought us out there. And that's kind of become home base where my brother and his family are. But I am out in Iceland right now. My wife is Icelandic, and I have a company out here and an office. So I'm most of the time I spend in Iceland, but I still go back and forth to see family and free dive and surf and get in the water.
All the things you don't necessarily want to do in Iceland without a very serious dry suit.
That's true. Although I do free dive here as well.
You're a brave man. Okay, let's dive into some photography. How did you get into photography? You've obviously come from Hawaii, a beautiful part of the world. What was your inspiration? What was the roots of your photographic journey?
I started taking pictures when I was 13 years old. A friend of mine came to visit me from South Korea, and their technology was far, far into the future compared to ours. And I was living in Abu Dhabi at the time, and he had this little 4-megapixel point and shoot camera, and I was blown away by what it could do. And I just started taking pictures of my friends skateboarding and our daily lives and whatever was around me. And that became an outlet for me to create some kind of art as well as to show the world around me. So that progressed, and I kept photographing different things in the world, little bugs and sunsets and palm trees and whatever it was that I could find. And I discovered a website called Flickr, where people were very generous in sharing information. I looked at these photos and had no idea how to create them. And bit by bit, just learning as I went, one day, you know, I figured out, I wonder what these numbers are on the bottom of my camera. And I discovered that was shutter speed. And what does shutter speed mean? And I noticed that if the number was small, then my photos would be blurry. And if the numbers were big, then my photos would be clear. So this was how I learned to take photos. And the desire to explore these different hidden worlds, such as the macro world, to see things close up, or night photography, where you can get photos of the Milky Way and really interesting features that you can't necessarily see with your eyes, is something that then translated over into even more extreme scenarios, like photographing the underwater world.
So you're self-taught, Karim, and you're a filmmaker as well. Which came first, and how do you combine them?
The photography came before the filmmaking. And when I started filming, it very much was filming the way that a photographer would film, which is to set up a frame that would be a nice photo and then press the record button and just stand around for a little while and then stop the recording. In some sense, that still is how I work. I start by shooting photos and then I swap over to video. But of course, filmmaking is a much more complicated endeavor in terms of the technical aspects of it. And there's more to think about in terms of the starting shot and the ending shot. But it does offer that flexibility of not trying to tell an entire story in one moment. And so I find both to be quite exciting, and they both have their places in the work that I do. And so it comes out to about 60% photo, 40% video, with some fluctuation.
You mentioned a little bit of underwater world. I'm assuming that's probably come from your Hawaii route. Spend a lot of time in the water. Tell us a little bit about the underwater world and your image making.
Yeah, so me and my brother were taking photos with our little point and shoot land cameras that eventually went from 4 megapixels to 5 megapixels. And we kept thinking about how good it would be if we could take these cameras underwater. But we would look at the cost of housing, and it was as much as the camera. And that seemed so crazy. So it took a number of years before I finally made the leap and I got a case for my camera. And by this point, I was using an SLR and a wide angle lens. And the moment that I started doing underwater photography was as if I had never done photography before. It was everything went right back to the beginning. All of the rules of how light and white balance and color and even the way that creatures move is completely different. When you're on land, everything is stuck to the ground by this magnetic force we call gravity. But underwater, gravity does not seem to apply. The animals are essentially flying through the water. And so one of your biggest obstacles becomes, how do I get to where I want to take the photo from? So it presented this whole new set of challenges that I found very interesting and exciting to try and figure out. But it also came with just as much reward. And you get these scenes that most people don't get to see. Most people aren't spending time underwater looking at turtles eating algae off of rocks while waves go overhead and surfers pass over you. And so to be able to photograph it in this kind of area meant that both for myself and for viewers, there was something completely new that could be gotten out of it that many people hadn't seen before.
I'm just going to pick up what Chris was talking about and where we were before, like with your photography and underwater world, and then the filmmaking coming in. Why did you start filmmaking? What was the desire to start to go from photography to filmmaking? Why did you do that?
That's a great question. I started filmmaking properly when drones became a thing that could be accessible and flown by more common people without such technical experience. The drone allowed me to finally have footage that was not shaky without the use of a tripod and that I could move. And that is something that previously required such complex systems. You either had to have a lot of patience and discipline to set up a tripod and get a shot, or you had to have, all kinds of gimbal systems and sliders. And so the drone allowed me to explore these three-dimensional spaces, and that was best done with video. Otherwise, if you take a photo with a drone from a high altitude, initially it could just look like you took a low quality image from on top of a mountain. But with the video, to get these movements, that opened up a whole new world. And then the ability to shoot slow motion video allowed me to look at these worlds that were previously hidden, things that are moving fast that you can then slow down, like a wave moving and turning. And to be able to show that kind of aspect and behavior in animals and natural ecosystems.
I mean, you said it was about a 60-40 split in favor of photo, but I'm kind of getting from this that actually the video is allowing you to do something that photos are not. And therefore, do you not find that the video pulls you first, or do you still think in a photo before you go for video?
The thing I love about photos is that when you take a photo, you can put it as the background on your computer. You can print it. You can sit and you can look at it and spend time with it. Whereas with video, even your favorite videos and your favorite video clips, how many times have you watched them? It's a more fleeting thing. And so I personally love to have that aspect of being able to sit with the details. And so I am still always drawn to photo and I first go for photo. However, if there is something that I immediately think this will translate better on video, I will start with video.
You described how you started off photographing basically anything and everything, but clearly you have an interest in the natural world. And looking at a website, you talk a lot about ecosystems and endangered species. That's very broad. Tell us a bit more specifically how that translates into your photography. What are the things that really pull you?
I do spend a lot of time going to far distant places to document the lives of these complex and hidden animals like humpback whales, sperm whales, blue whales. or large mammals out in the plains and the savannas of Africa. However, I do also try and spend just as much time or more to tell the stories of the little creatures that you find right in your backyard that people often don't pay attention to because they're used to it. And so I love photographing lizards, and the world of a lizard is often ignored and neglected by people. And so to see, how do they hunt? How do they move around? How do they communicate with each other? And you've got these little ecosystems. And the beautiful thing about this is that almost everybody has access to some kind of creature or animal, because we do have nature and wildlife all around us, even in cities or suburbs. And you really don't have to go to these far-flung reaches. So I spend a lot of my focus on documenting these animals and to try and tell their stories. And the main goal is to get people to care about our planet and to care about all of the life that lives here, so that we can try and work to protect this world, so that for many generations, everyone can, thrive and live and prosper.
Is it such a big leap as it would at first seem to photographing lizards and whales?
Is it a big leap to go from photographing lizards to
Yeah.
whales? A lot of it is about access, right? Not everybody has access to whales, but for me, it was a natural transition in the sense that if you never photograph any animals, nobody's going to call you up and say, "Hey, come and photograph a snow leopard or a tiger or a gorilla or a whale." But if you spend time really documenting and telling the stories of those animals that are around you, the benefit and the beauty of it is you have so much more time and access to spend with your local wildlife than you do with these far-flung animals, that your time is much more fleeting with them and they're more harder to find. And so as you establish yourself as a wildlife photographer, then those other op opportunities do open up.
Is that how you would describe yourself as a wildlife photographer, or is it a bit of a broader palette than just wildlife?
I like to photograph everything still, even today. I spend a lot of time documenting daily life around me. I love photographing people. I love photographing natural phenomena like northern lights or volcanoes or clouds. I think that people respond quite well to my wildlife photography, and it is something that is very passionate, that I'm very passionate about. So I wouldn't put myself just in the box of being a wildlife photographer. I do love to have a more broad approach, but I would say it is my specialty.
Suppose it leads on. You said you like photographing people as well. Personally, you shoot everything, but professionally, do you translate some of these stories that you're trying to tell of animals into human stories as well? Or do you leave the humans just for your personal, it's an enjoyable pastime?
I do also photograph people professionally, whether that's branded content, extreme sports with, surfers or windsurfers, kayakers, sometimes some, travel things. And so I think in today's world as a photographer, it's quite difficult to just pick one thing and only do one thing for work. But what you do have control of is what you put out there, the work that you want people to see and know you for. And so I think a big focus for me has been on showing that wildlife nature work, but at the same time, I am photographing many other things that involve people. And of course, there is nowadays, it's important to also tell the story of humans and animals together, because we live in a world where the two are very much overlapping in many spaces. There's a lot of pressures on ecosystems due to, populations expanding or resource extraction. And so those things are very intertwined. And if you want to tell a good story, then being able to combine the two is quite important.
Your thoughts on the state of the planet right now, and like where it is today, and where it's heading with these human wildlife interactions, conflict, however you might want to term it.
That is, it's definitely a mixed bag. It feels, on some hand, I feel like there's a lot of doom and a lot of destruction. And on the other hand, there's a lot of hope. Wildlife and nature is so resilient. And I've spent a lot of my time photographing these animals and thinking, like, okay, here, how do I do more? What can I do that is more than just showing people a nice photo of a fish and then saying, look at this fish, appreciate the fish. And so the last few years, I have been building a nonprofit called Kogia, where we've built this library of photos and videos that is freely accessible for those doing ocean conservation. It started off with me and my cousin who co-founded it, and we now have a team of volunteers, and we're trying to take all of this work that we've been doing underwater and in the ocean, as well as bring together all of these other photographers and filmmakers that want to do more with their work, and to take all of the stuff that is sitting on hard drives, is never being used, and to make that accessible for ocean conservation. And that's been going really well. We're very excited about that. We're launching on Earth Day, which is April 22nd. And so a big shift of my time and focus has also gone towards how can I do more in terms of conservation than just take aesthetically pleasing photos and videos.
It's a great initiative, I think. A great name as well. I'm curious because I used to be a marine biologist, and that's the genus name for sperm whale, dwarf sperm whale.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you have, I mean, you've obviously done a lot of work underwater. Did you have a scientific background, or is it, this has just come, you know, through your photography and experience underwater?
David, I'm very glad to hear that you already know what that is. I think you maybe are the first person we've come across that didn't ask us what a Kogia is. I am not a scientist by training, although I am, let's say, a hobby scientist or amateur, you know.
Citizen scientist.
Yeah, exactly. So I've always had a big interest in science, but I've taken the route of art. And so I spend a lot of time, you know, trying to learn about these animals. And why we picked the name Kogia is it's this animal that is so rare and hardly ever seen. I don't think there's any underwater footage of it. And it's this idea and the symbol that we have these animals in the ocean that we basically don't know about. They're almost mythical creatures, and yet they're there and they're real. And that kind of sums up the idea of we're trying to give voice to all of these creatures that don't have one, that people might not know about, and to tell their stories as well.
You kind of said you're going to give access to the image library to charities to use in conservation. I guess your long-term goal is conservation work, but how are you going to push this out there? Is it just contact, or do you have more lofty aims, getting involved through governmental initiatives or any of that?
So right now we've been in the beta mode, and we have members using the library in over 45 countries. Much of it has spread by word of mouth, and this library, it's built for scientists, activists, conservationists, small nonprofits, marine biologists to basically use in whatever their work is, that is, you know, those on the front line of conservation to try and protect our oceans. So in terms of our strategy for getting that out there, we do a lot of outreach. There's a lot of word of mouth. And, you know, we're also trying to engage the public in a way so that they feel that they're involved. There's often this disconnect between science and conservation and the public. And what, as media makers, filmmakers, and photographers, we're trying to bridge that, to get that science communication, so that when an important scientific paper is written, that there's beautiful imagery that goes along with it that can also capture the public's, you know, love and imagination and bring them into the fold, so that we don't have these little insulated bubbles of different groups trying to do different things.
Do you find being a non-scientific scientist that helps you to actually relate to what general public are trying to understand about this whole situation?
Absolutely. I think many scientists can get caught up in this certain ideas of everything has to be perfectly, perfectly correct and accurate before it can go out there at all. And we are in this dire state of rush that sometimes you just have to go with, you know, the heart instead of going with the mind. And I think that there's definitely something to be said about bringing the two together and going about it in a way that moves you forward and doesn't cause problems or create complications. But I think coming at this approach as a photographer and a filmmaker and being more nimble has been a huge advantage that I think a lot of scientists get held back having to be, you know, go through the motions in a very technically correct and meticulous way that we just don't have time for right now.
In your opinion, how dire is the state of the planet at the moment, and where do we find that hope?
I think that the scary thing is that the oceans are in a worse state than we think. And it's just comes with the nature of the ocean. It's one of those things where it's out of place, out of mind, right? And people across many generations have used the ocean as this kind of dumping ground. Like, oh, we can just, you know, we can throw trash in it. It also absorbs a lot of the carbon dioxide. You know, temperatures in the ocean warming up, it doesn't translate directly as we see it that something on land might. And so I think we are in for a huge, huge disaster if we don't change things fast. So that's where the worry comes in. The hope comes in that, like, when humans mobilize towards something, we can do a really good job and do it really quickly. And nature is resilient. It is not infinitely resilient, but if we get it together to actually give it a break before it's too late, I think it will recover and it will come back. But I think we're dancing on this line that is a cliff on both sides. And if we don't, you know, stabilize ourselves, I think it could be bad. But that is where I defer to, you know, the scientists and the experts who know much more about that, and to try and figure out how can we communicate this message to the general public, and also move from this idea that it's the public's fault, right? It's like, it's not the common person's fault that we're in this situation. It has now become our responsibility, and we have to hold, you know, the politicians and the companies accountable to change things. But, you know, one person by themselves, it seems like an impossible task to try and, you know, save the oceans or the planet. No matter how passionate you are about it, we really need to figure out how do we mobilize society as a whole to make these changes. And I don't know the answer. I'm just a small piece of it trying to figure it out.
It's a lot of hope. I think you're right. There is hope there. And humans do have the ability to do incredible things when they mobilize together. I don't know if there is the appetite yet to do it, because I don't think the average human has realized the severity of the situation. We tend to only do incredible things at the point that it's probably almost too late to do incredible things. And I don't know where we are in that point. A case in point, which is going to lead me on to the next question. You know, why did man end up going to the moon? Well, because there was an arms race and two countries, one wanted to get there before the other one. So we had huge technological development to get there. And now, 50 years later, you are going to be heading back around the moon with the Dear Moon project, which is obviously an incredible endeavor. And I'm curious to how that came about.
Yeah, that is very exciting. I've always been interested in space and wanted to go to space and to see and photograph the Earth from the perspective of the moon. And at some point, a friend of mine, she sent me a link to this project that was to bring 8 artists around the moon and to create something. And when we think about how the only people who've gone to the moon in the past have been, you know, military men, essentially, in the late 60s and 70s. And how amazing it is, the work that they produce, how that inspired people to, you know, it kickstarted the moonrise photo, Earthrise photo, kickstarted the environmental movement. These images changed people's perspective. And this was not artists. These were military and scientists. And so what happens when you send artists into space? What do they create? You know, how does that translate to human emotion and to tell the story of Earth and life on Earth? And so for me, the most exciting thing about this it's not about looking outward into space. It's actually about looking back towards our planet and to get a better, bigger, more whole perspective. And my hope is that I can use this opportunity and create images that will evoke emotion in people to really step up and do something, and that I can use it as a platform to give a bigger voice to those on our planet that don't have a say in how things go, whether that is, you know, plants or, you know, small bugs or even huge amounts of communities that don't have a seat at the table.
What was the process? I mean, you said your friend sent you a link, but once you got through that, what was the process of being selected, and what comes next? Training or goodness knows what?
So there was approximately 1 million people who applied, and there was a series of submissions, everything from writing to online meetings, interviews, medical checks, psychological checks, in-person meetings, group meetings, you know, intro video, all a whole series of things, as well as sending portfolio. And over the course of about a year, that group of, you know, 1 million applicants got narrowed down to a selection of 8 crew and 2 backups. Throughout that process, you know, I just took it one step at a time. Each time that I got an email and realized, okay, I've made it to the next step. This is exciting. If this is it, then I'm happy that I got this far. But of course, you know, that dream persisted and was there. And, you know, bit by bit, I made it through, and the crew was announced. Now we are just in the process of waiting for the SpaceX Starship rocket. As you probably know, building rockets is sometimes a slower process. You can't have a very accurate timeline. So we're in the state now where we're just waiting to hear more, when training will begin, when the launch will take place. And that's kind of just up to the progress of SpaceX and how their rocket technology goes.
And are you the only photographer on the crew? What are the other artists involved?
There's another photographer. She's specializes in a lot of fine art film photography, using Polaroid cameras and creating images in different mediums and using surrounding materials in those images to tell stories of humans. And there's also a filmmaker. There's some musicians and dancers and painters and choreographers and various mixed medium artists.
There must be limitations on what you're allowed to take. Have you like worked out what kit you might take or how you're going to approach this?
I think as far as I know, there's quite a lot of space on the rocket ship. It's the largest rocket ever built, with an interior capacity similar to a Boeing 747. And so I think that we'll have the opportunity to bring many things. And so in my mind, the ideal scenario would be to bring multiple cameras, multiple lenses, and obviously computers and hard drives and things like that. And everything from long lenses to wide angle lenses to low light lenses. I think it's one of those opportunities where you just bring as much gear as you have space for, so that you're prepared for all scenarios. And what's kind of fun and exciting to think about is that you don't actually have to carry it, because you're in a microgravity, zero gravity scenario. And so, you know, you could Velcro cameras onto yourself or stick them to the wall or even just let them float around. And you don't have this thing that you're just schlepping gear as you are on land. So that is, I think, going to be very exciting, but also challenging to figure out how do you shoot in space. And the closest thing I can imagine is that it would be similar to being underwater, you know, moving around in a three-dimensional environment. But of course, I don't think there's any way to prepare for that.
It's going to be interesting once you get into the training phase, see how that develops. But also, you know, if they do give you a payload amount, obviously, yes, space is massive. You've got limited space on a rocket, but you're not schlepping it around, but the rocket's still got to get it up there.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that could be very interesting.
Yeah.
Are they building special viewing windows for you on the spacecraft? Because
I sure hope so.
They're not very big, are they?
Yeah, I hope so. I know that, you know, SpaceX is a company that does value those kinds of things, like the optics of it, the views. I don't know if you saw the launch on March 14th, but they had incredible camera setups on the rocket and these amazing video clips of the rocket in space in orbit and coming back down. So I would imagine that the viewing opportunities will be quite good. I definitely hope that that is the case.
You'll get there and they'll say you can take one action camera. That's it.
And a small window so you can only get one shot.
Just enough for my eye to look through.
Yeah, that's it. Just like that. Yeah, I think it's a great initiative. And you're right, the people that have previously been to space have not been image-driven people. So having artists has the opportunity to create something incredible and potentially world-changing in the sense of bringing imagery back that might shift the public consciousness.
I hope so.
I hope you get the opportunity to do it the justice that it deserves.
So. That's going to be the biggest pressure, right? Is how do you do justice to such a big opportunity and such an important thing to document? And so I think just relying on all of the time and instinct and creativity and knowledge that I have practiced here on Earth and really getting myself ready for that.
Are there any technical issues with cameras working in zero gravity?
I know that Nikon has, you know, they supply the International Space Station with the camera gear. And so they've worked that out. I don't know how that applies to other camera companies like Sony or Canon, but I imagine that knowledge is probably in the public database enough that that can be worked out and checked and tested in advance.
And I know you're dependent on progress with SpaceX and the rockets themselves. Do you have any feel for timescale? Are we talking like a year, 5 years, 10 years? Do you have any guide to that?
There's nothing official as to when it might take off. You know, there's the original date, I think, was 2023, but there's speculation that ranges from 2026 to 2030, but it's so hard to actually know. The thing with SpaceX is that once they get moving, you know, things start going very, very quickly. They build rockets in a way where when they have one rocket ready to launch, they already have, you know, 3 to 5 rockets lined up to go next. So they're building it like an assembly line, one after the other, with each rocket having more advanced and more updated. And then they take everything from that launch, learn from it, and apply it into future iterations. And so that is a very different way than how NASA, for example, has traditionally built rockets, where they perfect the one rocket. And by the time they send that test rocket, it's good to go. And so, yeah, each SpaceX rocket you'll see will be very different and usually progresses much farther. And so the speed means that they'll be getting, at some point, they'll be able to get rockets up one after another, and then the progress will rapidly increase.
And on this mission, you're flying around the moon. We're not talking lunar landings here, are we?
No lunar landings, not this time. You know, maybe one day in the future. I would love to walk around on the moon, but that is a much bigger endeavor, and I think more complicated, more dangerous. So for now, a flyby will do just fine.
Let's bring it back down to Earth, and we're going to go back underwater. You've obviously done a lot of work with whales, and you take other people to swim with whales as well. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I went swimming with whales in 2014. I really love them. And I had been working on a whale watching boat in Hawaii. And so I would sit on top of this, you know, big boat. And there were these days that had glassy, perfect water. And I could look from the surface and I saw these whales. And all I wanted to do was be in the water and photograph them from underwater and to see them from underwater. And I had this, I kept wondering, how can I do this? And there was an Australian guy on the boat one day who told me that I should go to Tonga and that I could swim with whales in Tonga. So I went there and I had a great trip. I was very lucky. There was a lot of great interactions. One of my photos from that trip was printed as a 2-page spread in National Geographic magazine. And over the course of a few years, people had been asking me, how do I do this? Where did you do this? And I thought, you know what, how do I get back here? I'd been wanting to go back again. That one trip didn't feel like enough for me. But the only affordable way to do it was to run a trip where I organized the logistics, the accommodation, the food, the boat, all of the transport and set up basically a pop-up ocean safari company, which was very difficult. It's not something I necessarily would do if I knew how complicated it was going to be. And it was definitely trial by fire where I learned how to run that. And spending more time in the water with whales meant learning how these animals behave, guiding people. And that has become very successful with a lot of people who want to come and swim with whales. And so I now run trips where I take people in Tonga and French Polynesia and Dominica and Mexico, basically to come and experience what it's like to come face to face with these animals. And that's given me the opportunity to photograph and spend a lot of time documenting their lives and sharing that with other people, which has been very exciting.
There are certain times of the year where there's lots of whales around Hawaii. Why don't you do it there?
Hawaii is heavily restricted. The protections for humpback whales are very, very high. And there are so many whales out there and so many people that it would probably be a big disaster if they tried to let people swim with them there. It's also generally not how things operate in the United States with wildlife encounters. Whereas in some of these smaller Pacific islands that are much harder to get to and have less people, you know, it's not a perfect system, but it's something we constantly work at to try and have these small, intimate encounters with whales that are interested in interacting with us. And it's something that is quite interesting because you can't get out of your safari car to go and hang out with lions. In no sense would it be neither ethical nor safe. But with whales, they're such gentle, intelligent, and curious animals that you can get off of the boat and it's all on their terms. And if they want to, you know, they'll either let you observe them from a distance, and oftentimes they'll even come up and they'll swim around you, and they'll let the, you know, the calves are so big and the mothers are so big, they'll let their calves come and play with you. That might even be a thing that, you know, for the mothers that are tired and they're resting, having you entertain their calves for a while, whose primary job is to play, can be something that some of the mothers really like. And I've been with humpback whales that, you know, the moment that the mom sees that we're there, she'll bring the calf over to us and then go down and rest. And it's a very special experience.
And you mentioned humpbacks. What other species of whales have you swum with?
I have swum with blue whales, fin whales, sei whales, orca, sperm whales, as well as some of the smaller cetaceans like pilot whales and melon-headed whales and things like that. I've never swam with a cogia. That is something I hope one day to do. But yeah, mainly humpback whales and sperm whales.
And does the experience stand out more with one species than another, or are they all pretty special?
They are special for different reasons. Some species are more interactive than others. Humpbacks are quite playful and visually stunning with their big fins. And so for photography, it's great. They're kind of like the introductory whale, the whale on easy mode. Sperm whales are also can be quite social versus some whales like blue whales and sei whales and fin whales. It's more like a bus. And even if the person on the bus is quite interested in you, the bus is still going, or a train. And so I've swam with blue whales where the whale might turn and rotate and look at you, but in general, it'll just keep going. So they are very different. And it's not just from species to species, but from one individual to another individual. They have very different personalities and different moods. You can have a whale that one day or one hour wants to play with you and be with you, and then another hour it just wants to be alone or it wants to socialize with other whales. And so they are quite complex, like people.
You've just come back from Svalbard, I believe, an expedition there. What were you doing?
I was working with a company called Natural World Safaris, who I'm starting to work with more. They run wildlife tours around the world. I am primarily at heart a photographer and filmmaker. And so the more time I can spend out in the field documenting this wildlife and interacting with people, the better for me, rather than doing the logistics of trying to run my own trips. And so that's something I'm moving more towards. And for this trip in Svalbard, this company, they want to try and do trips that have more of a conservation focus, as well as telling important stories of what's going on here on Earth. And so this one, it was called Journey to Nature's Edge. And as you probably know, in the Arctic and the Antarctic, these are very delicate ecosystems. Despite their harsh, rugged terrain and weather, they're very susceptible to climate change and melting ice. And so the goal of this project was to try and figure out, you know, how can you bring some artists together to tell that story and evoke some emotion with people, and to try and figure out what's the next step. And it's a complicated thing. How do you tell the story of the Arctic and the animals and the ecosystem that is there? You know, I don't have the answer for that, but in the meantime, it's about connecting people to that place, getting photos and videos that can be used to tell that story, and then seeing what comes of it.
And the effects of climate change are being seen more in the Arctic at the moment, aren't they, than anywhere else? So that's a really important story to tell.
Exactly. In Svalbard, there's the global seed vault, which is supposed to be, you know, they put scientists put the seeds for, you know, humanity to protect in the far reaches of, you know, the far north of the world, with this idea that, like, this is a good place. It's a frozen landscape. And yet still, you know, now you look at it and you think, oh, maybe this is not secure enough. I think they had, I wouldn't quote me perfectly on this, but I think there was even some issue with some flooding or something happened because, yeah, temperatures are changing out there at a much higher pace than other parts of the world.
We'll draw to a close now because we've kind of covered an awful lot, but I'm curious, beyond your Dear Moon, what is next? Obviously, the Dear Moon project has an unfixed timeline, but what does the next few years hold for you?
The next few years, it's hard to say exactly. A big focus of my time is going towards Kogia, which we will also expand to have land photos and videos. So it's not, won't just be ocean focused, as well as some other projects that are part of Kogia. I am also expanding outward my photography. I've put a big focus on photographing whales and underwater, but I want to spend more time photographing more land species, things like bears and big cats, birds here in Iceland, and to try and look at, you know, what bigger projects can I do that tell stories, so that I'm not just producing one-off beautiful images, but how do I tell stories that combine, you know, humans and nature? Or how do I tell stories that inspire people, showing different communities in the world, different cultures, and how they interact with each other and how they interact with the planet? And to really just see, follow where my work takes me and where my passion takes me, and see what I can do with that. So it's hard to plan out and say exactly what's to come. That's the exciting thing about the future, is you don't know what's next. But in the meantime, I'll be working on these other projects and continuing trying to get outside as much as possible and spend time in the field taking photos.
And Chris is slightly grinning because he thinks we're going to get out of this podcast without the question that I ask everybody. Regular listeners will know what's coming up. We've just looked forwards. So now we're going to take a very quick look back. If you could go back in time and maybe talk to the younger you, is there one bit of advice or an inspirational saying or something that you would say to the younger you that you think would stand you in good stead?
The most difficult thing that I've had a hard time with, and I know a lot of other artists and creatives have a hard time with, is figuring out what the most important thing is to do that will progress you, and doing that first. I spent so much time doing all of the small tasks that were not important and procrastinating the big things. And so I would tell myself, constantly write down, what are your goals? What are the things you want to achieve? What are the most important things? And then only do those.
That was,
I think, that's fantastic advice. I think that's fantastic advice for everybody at any stage of life, to be honest. Yeah. And I think it certainly resonates with me as a fellow procrastinator.
I have not mastered it. Every day I try and go into this mentality again and again, and I found that it works wonders when you do get it right.
Karim, that's been really fascinating talking to you. Your passion for so many things comes through, your passion for nature, your passion for your photography and for telling stories, whether that be with a camera or with in the filmmaking sense. So I'd like to thank you for sharing all of that with us. Wish you the very best with some of those exciting projects you've got, both in the near term and the longer term with the space venture. And thank you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to both of you today.
Thank you for joining us.